This is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We're going to go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers. Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways.
And Adam Nathan.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in.
We are going to follow you. You lead us, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Go Hawks.
You know, I think that we've been successful running it, you know, this season. I think we've also been very, very successful throwing it. You know, I think that we've been able to throw the ball really well. We haven't thrown it a crazy a ton amount, but when we have, we've thrown it very, very well. Guys have made plays. Ty Lockett's been special all year. Doug, when he's played, he's been amazing. Guys have caught the ball really well. You know, I think that when you reflect back on it, you know, we're throwing it pretty well in the game, you know, and I think we could have kept doing that, you know, some more. But also you want to stay true to running the ball too. You know, so I think that, like I said, you know, this game was kind of similar to the Carolina game, I felt like, a little bit. They did a pretty good job of stopping us on the run. In that game, we had to throw the ball, you know, and make some plays. And I think this game was kind of similar in that sense. If we could have done that a little bit more, maybe earlier. But I think also, too, we could have been better. You know, we could have been better on some of the runs and some of the things we were doing. And, you know, that's part of the game, you know. Sometimes you shoot and sometimes it doesn't go in. Sometimes you shoot and it keeps going in.
Well, that is that. The 2018 season for our Seattle Seahawks has come to a frustrating and disappointing close of the first hurdle in the NFL playoffs. This is another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast. Myself, Stuart Court, is, as ever, joined by Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm not so bad. I did float with you on Sunday. Why don't we just, you know, get the match review out of the way? I think tempers would have been too hot at that time to do it. So the wise old heads, it's Wednesday evening now, and I think maybe a tiny bit cooled down, so this should be a slightly better show, I think.
Yeah, I think brown envelopes by a bloke doorstepping us in a car park maybe in our future for the dinner on Sunday. And also this week to help talk us about talk over wildcard game in Dallas and a general 2018 season review is Rob Staton. How are we, Rob?
Yeah, good, thanks guys, thanks for the invite, and I'm sure we're gonna have a lot of interesting things to discuss about this game and the season in general.
So we'll start off, obviously the main headline is obviously what the scoreboard looked like as the final second ticked off the clock on the early hours of Sunday morning. The Dallas Cowboys winning out 24-22, going on to face what is now going down to New Orleans and face the Saints after what happened on Sunday in Chicago. A lot has been said, a lot has been written by all various means, a lot of people getting on their collective pedestals about certain things, but what was your main overriding feeling at the end of that game on Sunday morning, Adam?
I think overall I was a bit frustrated because you can always accept losing, and in hindsight, you know, going into a place where the opposition were 7-1 at home on the season, playing a style of game that is not really what we're necessarily going to be that good at. And I think I was frustrated partly because it was 5 o'clock in the morning and we just lost, which is never a good time to lose anything. But also I felt that, you know, it was almost there for us, and when you lose with regret, that's always going to be slightly more frustrating than just, you know, taking a pace thing. Obviously, there's a lot to look forward to in the future, but, you know, the future is going to be 8 months away in the new season, and I'm kind of not patient enough for that. And I really wish we were playing again on Saturday, and unfortunately, we're not. So I think frustration was my overriding opinion. I don't know what you think about that, Rob.
I felt a little bit differently. I just felt really disappointed because I just think that they played very poorly. Mm-hmm. And if I actually think I would have felt a little, I don't know if I'd have felt better actually. If they'd have played really well and lost against the Dallas team, as you mentioned, that was 7-1 on the road, at least it could have been that. You know, when they lost to Atlanta in 2012 in the playoffs there, you came away afterwards feeling really positive about the performance. Yeah, they threw it away, but there was a lot of things to be proud of and to be excited about. Whereas with this, it felt a little bit like we'd watched a continuation of the performances against San Francisco and Arizona. They just didn't play well at all. And I know you could pick out various things, like, you know, Russell Wilson made some great plays to Tyler Lockett and Doug Baldwin. The defense had some very good stops. But there were also mistakes by all three facets of the game. The running game never got going. The defense giving up that hideous run to Zeke Elliott before halftime, which meant they didn't go in at halftime with a lead and a possession afterwards. The fact that they gave up two huge scoring drives in the fourth quarter, couldn't defend the lead, and the third and 14 play at the end, which essentially killed any chance of Russell Wilson having that one shot at the end to lead the team to an improbable victory. So I was just really disappointed, because at the very least you expected them to play fairly well, I think, and I think they let themselves down.
I think I may have said it to you, Adam. I think going into the game, that was the main... It was which Seahawks we were going to get, if it was going to be that Arizona or San Francisco one, or if it's going to be the one that play Kansas City and Minnesota so differently, so like Jekyll and Hyde-esque, and we definitely got the latter. I think a bit of frustration and disappointment for me, because I think there's so many clear opportunities, you say, Rob, with the third and 14, the long Zeke run. Obviously, you've got a couple of plays where the turnovers could have been made when they weren't made, also all the passing plays, which we'll get onto in a bit. But there's such clear examples and opportunities where if the play or the thing goes differently or swings more in our favour, then we're previewing a game and not reviewing a season, I think, because it was so clear, and there's so many clear examples of opportunities missed by a hair's breadth in some examples. I think that's the most disappointing and frustrating thing with a long look to what's coming next. Obviously, the offensive side of the ball has got most of the attention, even with all the 14 points given up in the fourth quarter on those two drives. The running game, obviously the main conversation also is all over the internet and Twitter and everything, is the play calling. What's your thoughts on the play calling on Sunday morning, in particular, Rob?
I mean, I think that Seahawks Twitter has really let itself down again, which is a shame. I think that the reactions to it reek a little bit of a bunch of people who've been dying to have their "I told you so" moment. And with the team, I mean, you look at it, the Seahawks started 0-2 and were awful, and then they turned to the run and finished the year 10-4. And amongst those four losses were two very close games against an LA team that destroyed them last year, towards the end of the year, and could easily have been wins. And they were very competitive in those two games, so they could. I thought that was a very strong recovery from 0-2 playing this way. And I think that a few people have been waiting to have their moment, and I think that they saw this as a chance to have their moment. I think that they're also being a bit over. I mean, there's one or two people who've really let themselves down. I think that maybe having 5,000 or 6,000 Twitter followers has gone to the head a little bit, and they've got carried away, and they're a little bit immature and need to grow up a little bit and stop trying to be sort of outspoken and interesting and edgy and try and just enjoy following a great team. And that, I mean, for me, to go to the play calling itself, I see a lot of people saying they should have done this, they should have adjusted, they should have done that. I've seen comparisons to the Carolina game, and they used that as an example of when they adjusted. They came out and ran the ball, I think, three times to start the second half against Carolina. Kept running, even though it wasn't working there. Yes, they turned to the pass when there were 7 points down with 6-7 minutes to go in the game, but that's not a comparison you can make. People said they threw more against Kansas City. They actually ran the ball, I think, 13, 14 more times than they passed against Kansas City, ran for over 200 yards in that game. These are not examples that people can use. In this particular game, it was never more than a 3 or 4 point deficit. I don't personally think a team should throw out its game plan and its what has worked for it for so long because you're trailing by 3 or 4 points. Does that mean that they should have done exactly what they did? No. I mean, I think that they could have tried some different runs. I think that it would have been useful to maybe try some wide receiver screens. I know that's a play that a lot of people don't like, but there was a lot of pressure up the middle and they were stacking the box, and he might have just spread things out a little bit to throw a few of those in early in the second half and say, look, we're going to try and hit him on the outside. Zeke was stretching everything outside, if you watch that. I think they were deliberately trying to get away from the defensive line. I'd love to see the Seahawks try and do a little bit more of that. Could they have passed a few more times? Yes. But what it comes down to for me is they just didn't execute. I mean, the run game was terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been great for most of the year. They didn't do a good enough job in the run game. The offensive line didn't do a good enough job. And you mix it in with a couple of bad special teams plays, the fact the kicker was injured, and the fact that the defense gave up two huge scoring drives and a big back-break in third and 14 right at the end. It all adds together towards a losing effort. But, I, you know, to just come out after that game and say it's they should have just thrown it 40 times. People have got short memories. They don't remember those first two games.
Adam?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, I'm probably slightly differing in opinion, but I probably am going to say things more to play devil's advocate as opposed to because I strongly believe all of these things, because as you say, there's so many different facets that you can look at. But in a way, in thinking about it, I kind of feel that the Cowboys game was more like the first two games of the year than any other, in the sense that they went into the game like with a plan, and they almost ended up being a little bit too resolute with the plan. I mean, the thing I've said to Stu loads of times this year that watching some of the offense hasn't been my cup of tea, but you can't say it's not been effective. It's been great. But I think this week was the first time where they just didn't seem to make adjustments either way that they had done so well in the past season. I mean, I was thinking about games against Oakland and Detroit and Carolina, as you say, and Kansas, where, I don't know, they just seem to mix it up a bit more and be a bit more balanced versus this is what we're going to try and do and that'll be the end of it. And I just wonder if, you know, obviously Pete said, you know, maybe we could have done a little bit more of this and a little bit more of that. And I almost think that the failure in the first two games of the season, whilst obviously that's not the way they could play, but, you know, in week two of the season, Ryan Fitzpatrick was seen as the best quarterback in the NFL, and no one had seen Baker Mayfield make a throw. So much can change that, I don't know, it almost seemed that they got so scared of what they saw in those first couple of weeks that they were terrified of turning to it. Now, I think that they absolutely should have stuck with the plan that got them there, at least until halftime. And then I guess, you know, the third quarter, you can say, should have done a bit more passing or whatever. I personally would have liked to have seen that, but I don't blame them for sticking to their guns. But yeah, I just wonder if almost playing scared and not adjusting out of fear of what the other side could hold held them back a little bit more. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, Rob, but you can try and make hash of it.
I mean, I don't personally think they were that fearful. And I think there were things that people have sort of forgotten a little bit about as the, you know, because the reaction to the game was, and it was, and look, I think it's a very easy conclusion to come to. Why did they just do this? Because the big pass plays worked. But it's very easy to forget that they start the second half with a big run from Rashard Penny. Mm-hmm. And that probably encouraged them a lot more and thought, actually, we can get this going. You know, there is still time. I think they had something ridiculous, like it was like 25 yards rushing at half time, and by towards the end of the third quarter, it was up towards 75. They're probably thinking, if we get above 120 yards in this game, we'll probably win this game. And if they've sort of got that mentality, because that's the way they've played all year, I could understand sort of sticking with it a little bit. They also didn't really, I mean, the third down thing was terrible. And I think people have kind of written this off and said, this is just Pete making an excuse for his philosophy. But it is true. They just weren't good on third downs. You know, nothing worked. You know, could they have called better plays? Yes, definitely. They could have called better plays. They could have executed better. You can sort of level any criticism at them at that. But really, that was the big difference. I mean, Mike Sando sort of did a comparison between the first game against Dallas and the second game. And actually, the Seahawks do a lot more passing against Dallas in this game. I mean, all of the statistics are weighted towards the pass in this game compared to in the first game. The one big difference is that when they played Dallas the first time, there were 7 of 16 on third downs and 2 of 13 this time. And one of those two third down conversions was Mike Davis running up the gut with about 6 seconds to go to set up the kick that Janikowski got injured on. So I don't necessarily think they were fearful. I think people have... I think people allowed their expectations. I'm not talking about you guys, but I think people allowed their expectations. I certainly did, to sort of get a bit carried away. I was starting to dream of a playoff run. You know, I mean, why wouldn't you at this point? I mean, you've got to live for these moments. So I think that the fact that it ended so crushingly after one game and against a quite irritating opponent in the Dallas Cowboys has had a bad impact on people, and people want to jab a finger at somebody. And it happens to be Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer on this occasion. But another quick thing, I mean, I'm not his publicist or anything, but Mike Sando, again, put a very interesting stat out a few hours ago. In the second half of the season, leaders in offensive points per game over 2018. Chiefs top with 33, Rams second with 30, Seahawks third with 28.5 above the Saints and the Colts. So they were doing something right on offense in that second half of the season. Russell Wilson statistically had his best year. Tyler Lockett did. Doug Baldwin did. Clark and Reed did on defense. The style suited that roster for me. And sort of sticking to what has suited them and has had some success, I personally don't have a problem with. I just wish they'd have played better. That's my biggest complaint. They didn't play well. Defense, offense, special teams did not play well enough to deserve to win that game. And that's what I'm most disappointed about. I'm not going to live with regret that they didn't throw it 40 times.
Fair. And this might be more of Pete Carroll in general, but you know, we're always seeing videos of him in the locker room of, you know, can you win it in the first quarter? No. Second quarter? No. And, you know, Seahawks Twitter, as you say, has disgraced itself to a new level this week. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But one side that I've been interested was seeing the defenders of Schottenheimer and Carroll saying, well, you know, it was 14-10 in the fourth quarter. We were winning, so surely that means the plan's working. And I actually, you know, I think it's a very fair point. The one thing I'd say in response to that is that if you try and kind of take pride in the fact that you play close games, eventually you're going to lose one. And as much as you can be happy to be 14-10 up, I just wonder if, you know, we're probably good enough to be 21 or 24 if they'd gone a little bit more. And, you know, I'm probably more looking long term here, and he's probably not going to change because he's a late 60s-year-old man. But is there a little bit of flexibility that we could see in Carroll that could help this team a lot by saying, you know, you can score a few more points? Like Marshawn said, coming off after his touchdown in Super Bowl 48, you know, can we score some more? Because we're good enough to do it. There's good players there.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say very quickly to that point is, you know, as I pointed out, you know, in the second half of the year, they were scoring more points per game than the Saints and the Colts. You know, only the Chiefs and the Rams were in it. So they've actually scored, on average, 28 points. I think this was a bad day at the office, you know, that they've only scored, what was it, 22 in the end. Mm-hmm. Is probably, you know, that's down 6 points on their average from the halfway point in the season. They were actually scoring a lot more than that. And if they'd have got their average for the second half of the year, they'd have won the game. You know, they'd have scored 28. So I think part of it comes down to it being a bad off day, and you have to give Dallas credit. They did shut down Seattle's running game very, very well. If Seattle had done that to Dallas, we'd have all been saying what an outstanding defensive achievement. I think the other thing is that I think that Pete will be, I'm not going to use the word more flexible because I don't think he is going to change anything, but I think we'll be better equipped to succeed next year because I think part of this has been limiting the possessions is about the roster again and the defense, because I think the defense has significant weaknesses. I don't think Bradley McDougal has had a great year, but I don't think you can look at that secondary and say you feel with any great confidence they're going to shut anybody down. Bobby Wagner's going to be Bobby Wagner. They've had to play a lot of the year without KJ and a lot of the year without Michael Kendricks. And the pass rush and the defensive line, look, it has good games and it has bad games, and run defense has not been good enough all year. I think that he probably feels like they've had to limit possessions just to give themselves a chance to be in those games. Because if they're, you know, stacking up the possessions and putting the defense on the field a lot, I think he possibly thinks that they can't play that way, that they will end up conceding a lot more points, and that in turn will put more pressure on the offense. I think if they can improve the defense and get more talent on the defense next year, then that will give them a chance. I don't know whether to necessarily play any differently, but it will make them maybe feel confident about certain scenarios. And if they are continue to score at a pace of 28 points a game, if the defense is doing a lot of better job and is a lot more talented, and there's an opportunity to do that this offseason, then I think they'll be a lot more competitive as a contender.
Yeah, I think what you said on about the 14-10, I think that's the kind of thing where I was pointing to, with there was opportunities there. Obviously, the Rashad Penny, he has four runs. He only had six snaps in Dallas. So if it was clearly something working, they just went away from it. Like the next play, when it got blown off, I think he lost 7 yards on the next play, on a toss play. He just went away from things like that so quickly when he clearly had something which could have been got going, and they just went away from it. And there's a few plays where you could have saw Russell Wilson get the ball in his hands a bit quicker and stuff like that. Because it just seemed, I think I said, Rob, I think I was one of those people who was really reactive on Sunday morning and just kind of wanted everyone fired and went to bed in a bit of a grump kind of thing. But like looking back, we kind of knew what we were going into in 2018 the minute the OC was named as Brian Schottenheimer, because he's only ever really done things one way. And the fact that people seem surprised and disappointed that he did it this way on the biggest stage of the season that they were put on is a bit like selective memory, isn't it?
Well,
to a certain extent.
Without want to, just to sort of quickly respond to that, I think one thing, the reason Brian Schottenheimer's got this job is because he's willing to do everything that Pete Carroll wants. And this is, you know, this isn't like a lot of other head coaching jobs. You know, Pete Carroll is a defensive-minded head coach, but he decides what they do on offense as well. You know, he's got a very firm control on that offense. And Schottenheimer's there because he will do everything that Pete wants. So I think sometimes when people point at Brian Schottenheimer, what they really need to do is point at Pete Carroll because this is his offense. It just so happens that he employs people, Bevel, Cable, Schottenheimer, to run it his way. So that's the first point on that. I whether or not this is a thing that is going to be a long-term issue or not, I don't know. I just personally feel they had a bad game, a really bad game. And if they'd have had that bad game, if this was a bad game in week 14, I would have bet money that the following week the Seahawks would have played a lot better the following week if this was a regular season game, would have come out flying and probably played the way they did against the Chiefs. The problem is that because it's the playoffs, they don't get a chance to do that next week. So it's massively frustrating for that. They did let themselves down. It's horrible to end a season that way, but I kind of feel, as bad as it was, that there is a bit of perspective there that hopefully, you know, this is a team that is growing and with a bit more talent on defense next year, they can be even more of a contender and push the Rams to the NFC West.
The Atlanta point's an interesting one from 2012, because as you say, when that game finished, you really just wished week one of the following year was going to be the season after. You were seeing the emergence of real star players that, you know, we probably would have won the Super Bowl that year. I don't think I'm being hyperbolic to say that if we'd got through that game, I think we would have gone all the way. I don't necessarily feel that quite level of optimism this year round, and I just wonder if you think the core is there, that it's 1 year away, or is there a little bit more to do than that, especially with only four draft picks? I kind of feel it might be a slightly more longer-term plan than that.
I think we're a mile away from what the team was in 2012. I mean, you just sort of have to reel off the names, Cam Chancellor, Richard Sherman, Earl Thomas, Brown, who was still, look, you don't need me to reel off all the names. It was a loaded team. And then they went and added Percy Harvin, Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill in the space of about a week when free agency started. So, you know, they were a loaded team. Yeah. I mean, probably as talented as a roster that has graced the NFL, probably in the time I've been watching I can't think of another roster that's got that close to being that good in my time following the league. I suspect probably if we went down and through probably in my lifetime, you know, there's probably not been a roster as loaded as that. So no, they're nowhere near the 2012. What they have got is several pieces in place that you need, I think, to be a very strong contender in an NFC where there's maybe been exposed a little bit, that has shown that it's a little bit more open than we thought. So you've got a quarterback who's very good. You've got a left tackle that is serviceable. You've got a running game that works and an O-line that works. And you've got some playmakers with Baldwin and Lockett. On defense, you've got a dynamic pass rusher in Frank Clark who's taken a step forward. You've got that interior force in Jaron Reed. You've got Bobby Wagner, who's the best linebacker in the league. And you've got Bradley McDougal. So you've got sort of a core and a foundation there. You've got a clear identity. I think they've got a very, very good head coach. Not saying he's flawless by any stretch, but I think one of the better, I'd rather have him than some of the coaches that are going to be appointed or have been appointed in the last couple of days. And that's that. But they've got to keep adding. So can they add another pass rusher? Can they improve the competition and the quality of the secondary? You know, they're two things that have to happen this offseason. Another pass rusher, better run defense. They need somebody who can be Tony McDaniel up the middle there and stop some of these easy runs that they gave up too often this year. They need more quality in the secondary. Is that one player? Is that two? Not sure. And can they add another weapon on offense? And then if they can do those things in this offseason, and they have usually been very aggressive in offseasons, whether that's getting players out or getting players in, then they can be strong next year. They're never going to be 2012, 2013. But can they be very competitive with the Rams? Yes. Can they quickly emerge as a team that can compete with New Orleans at the top of that conference? Yes. I mean, New Orleans were a 7-9 team for 3 years in a row, and then last year became a really strong outfit. So the Seahawks have never regressed to 7-9. They're still up there. There could be one good draft and maybe a couple of astute free agent signings away from being a real force in the NFC.
Yeah. Rob, you talked about on defense side limiting possessions. was to like protect the defense because all the flaws and the holes that that unit may have. But also, everyone talking about Russell Wilson throwing the ball more. Is this team even built to do that? Also, because Russell Wilson was sacked more in 2018 than he has been in his career. So if it means passing it more and more efficient, because obviously had the stat where he was it completed more passes into tight windows than any other quarterback. The wide receivers, he's basically got Doug Baldwin and Tyler Lockett, who's had a year like no one expected. I don't think Tyler Lockett expected. So this team in 2018 also wasn't probably built to pass the ball more, and the run game kind of has kind of covered over that a little bit. Do you think that's accurate or close to?
I think there's some truth to that. I think the offensive line is clearly built to run the ball. I mean, you've got DJ Fluker there. He's never going to be an amazing pass protector, is he? I mean, look at the guy. Yeah. And then Jermaine Ifedi's never been a good pass protector. But then, both of them, the size on that right-hand side, it's built for run blocking. J.R. Sweezy's athletic, but is a better run blocker. I think Justin Britt's probably in the same category. And then Dwayne Brown has his moments, shall we say, as a pass protector where he gives up a sack. So I don't think that line's built there. I think if you were sort of asking Russell to drop back a lot, we'd be saying the offensive line's not very good. He would be getting sacked quite a lot. I think that would be an issue. The sacks then end up taking away a lot of the run stuff because you're in, you might be second and 20, second and 17 a lot of the time. Then you've got to pass again. You get behind the eight ball. And these are things that could have potentially happened there. And I think that they sense that. And look, there's no way to prove that was a serious concern without them sort of just going on a six-game blast where they throw as much as they did last year because they had no running game. But I think that is possibly true. And listen, I get it that people read the analytics and the analytics will tell you that there's a better percentage of success in scoring if you throw on certain downs and distance. I don't think that stuff should be ignored by any stretch. But I always kind of come back to this comparison. There are some sports like baseball where you can pretty much one size fits all. You know, you can sort of get a structure of things and go, this is what wins. And if you get this guy and he's got this kind of on-base percentage, and those things work in baseball. For me, the NFL I like to make more of a comparison to sort of the, football in England. In that you look at the last three World Cup winners, France, Germany, and Spain, all very different teams, all doing it in a very different way. It may be that the way France won it, the percentages were stacked in that style versus the way that Spain played it. But the fact is that three very different styles won the last three World Cups. And I think there's some of that in the NFL. I think that there may well be a style that down by down gives you a certain percentage better chance of success than if you do running the ball, for example. But that doesn't necessarily work for every team on the same level. It doesn't necessarily work for a team where you've got weaknesses on the offensive line in pass protection. And if you've got a quarterback like Russell Wilson that can fit those passes into those tight windows, that can be the classic point guard, that can extend plays when you need to, that can throw downfield as well as he can. He's the best deep ball passer in the NFL right now. And the number of explosive plays they had and the numbers that he put up to Tyler Lockett and himself, it's less of a concern for me with that. And I'd like to see them get another weapon in there and be even better next year. But I think you have to say, it's the second most points in franchise history they scored in 2018. The only other season that's better than that's 2005. So there has been a lot of success this year. I think sometimes that's forgotten a little bit because people kind of made their mind up on Brian Schottenheimer before he even started. And I think people have been swayed a little bit too much by Seahawks Twitter's addiction to analytics.
Where are you both standing on Wilson right now? I mean, I went into the season thinking that, $35 million, that's going to be a huge percentage of the cap. Is he, going to be worth that? And I'm seeing some things now, someone ridiculously saying, well, if the Seahawks are going to play like that, they should just trade Russell Wilson away for three first-round picks because, you could put any grandma back there and do the same job. I have to say I come out of this season thinking Wilson can have that $35 million quite happily, and I'll make it work around that more than happily.
Yeah.
He's impressing more this year than probably any other this year, which I really was not expecting to say. Presumably it's a clean sweep that if that's what is going to be the deal that we're going to have to make, we make it,
because I mean you can just see the teams that are left in these you saw on Sunday what the difference, what how a defense can key into an inexperienced or possibly in the passing game with Lamar Jackson, how you can just completely shut that down with just a bit of scheming. The haves and haves not at the quarterback position in the NFL, there's probably no wider margin, no wider gap. And to have a quarterback like Russell Wilson, who is top five, top six in the league this year and has been, but is like overall, you cannot just let that walk away just overpaying him. You pay him the market, and then you just hope that the play continues, and that two, that you can build a team around him with what's left of the cap that can keep you in contention and keep you in the playoff picture come January.
Do you know what the interesting thing is about this? Is that Alex Smith signed a contract with an average worth $25 million a year ago. Now, Alex Smith's a good quarterback, but any other quarterback that's on the market this offseason is going to ask for the same kind of money. So Nick Foles, whether he wins or loses at the weekend, is going to ask for that kind of money. Joe Flacco, if he gets released by the Ravens, is going to be asking for that kind of money because Alex Smith got it. So, you know, are you prepared to pay Joe Flacco $25 million? Is that $10 million saving really going to make that much of a difference to your roster? I mean, what is that, half a defensive end? You know, is it you know, one of Frank Clark's shoes? You know, I mean, what are you really getting for $10 million on the open market that it warrants the downgrade from Russell Wilson to Joe Flacco? So it's an absolute no-brainer. I've never been a one to sympathise with the idea that, well, you can just win with any old quarterback if you're going to run the ball. I think they've got the best point guard in the NFL. I think Wilson is a sensational player, and I would happily pay him. The one thing I will say, though, is if Kyler Murray's there at number 21 overall, I'm taking that guy. I mean, he's really, really good. And then in 3 or 4 years' time, you've got a decision to make on what you do with old Russell there when he's pushing my age now. So yeah, I'd think about that, but you know, you've got to keep Russell Wilson without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah. And Kyler Murray's the only way you could get a smaller quarterback in there as well.
Yeah, that's true.
But obviously on Saturday, the other guys, Doug Baldwin caught one of the best toe drag swag catches of the year, 3 for 32. Tyler Lockett passed 100 yards yet again. 4 catches, 120. But Ed Dixon got a 4 for 42. JD McKissick also is someone who seems to have been used slightly weirdly since he's come back on the active roster, Rob. Is he someone who you hope to see more in 2019, JD McKissick, if he makes the team?
I'm pretty indifferent on him. I mean, if he comes in and has an impact, then great. I mean, I'm certainly not holding out any hope that he does that. He seems to be very popular with the team and the players. You just have to see the way that Doug Baldwin reacted to the JD McKissick getting what was essentially a garbage time touchdown there at the end, which gave them a chance for Michael Dixon just to boot it up in the air and not give them a chance to recover that onside kick. So he's very popular. So, I'll keep my fingers crossed for him that he can have an impact there. I would love to see it happen. I think they need to find another weapon from somewhere. Now, whether that's David Moore taking a step forward, he disappeared at the end of the year, whether that's McKissick, whether that is Amara Darbo finally breaking through, whether it's Jaron Brown, whether it's somebody on the outside. You know, the good thing about the draft class that's coming up, there's not really anybody that you'd sort of bang the table for in round one, but there are going to be receiver options, you know, very fast, very explosive receivers available in rounds 2 to 4. So if the Seahawks trade down, which they're inevitably going to do, they've only got 4 draft picks and can get a few more picks in that sort of 3rd, 4th, 5th round range, then they will have an opportunity, I think, to add somebody who can come in and contribute in the way that maybe even Tyler Lockett did as a 3rd round pick as a rookie. So I think there's going to be some options there, and I'd like to see them bring in at least another weapon there. There's room for this offense to be even better, but I think they need one more guy.
Yeah, and obviously they've got Will Disley to add to all that as well next year, hopefully.
Uncle Will.
Yeah, Adam?
Is there an offensive Derwin James that, you know, the Seahawks obviously traded down the pick after Derwin James was taken by the Chargers. Is there an offensive Derwin James that if, you know, X player is there at 21 and we haven't traded down yet, you say, stuff that, you got to take him?
No, I don't think so. I think there are players, for example, Ohio State, one of them has actually said he's going to return, which is KJ Hill, but they've got 3 receivers, Victor Benjamin, Paris Campbell and Terry McLaurin, who are just freaks of nature. I mean, McLaurin he's going to be like a 4.3 runner, decent size, 40 plus inch vertical at the combine when he gets there. And, you know, they're the types of players that, And he had a really good year. I mean, the thing about Ohio State is they spread the ball around a lot. And a lot of Dwayne Haskins' completions are just basically extended hands-offs, you know, screens, bubble screens. I think he's a little bit overrated because they just get it in the hands of the playmakers and do that. And, I'd much rather go down that route. Look, there's a guy called Marquise Brown who is from Oklahoma. And if you've watched Hollywood Brown. Yes, Hollywood Brown. I've actually been to Hollywood in Miami where he's from, and it's not what you'd expect. It's nothing like the Hollywood LA. But it's I watched a world title fight there once. The thing about him is he's actually Antonio Brown's cousin. So there's a relation there with Antonio Brown, and if he's anything similar, then that's a player that you'd probably think, with Russell Wilson's deep throw ability and his playmaking, could he be an option there? And that's probably the best one that I can think of. I mean, they're not going to take a running back again in round one. There's not really an offensive lineman that I would say is worth shouting about. Cody Ford's probably the best one at Oklahoma, but he's more of a tackle who's going to kick inside to guard. So Marquise Brown, probably the one in the first round that you would sort of say could be some interest, but it's set up at the playmaking positions, running back, wide receiver. Middle rounds are going to be the best option this year.
In that window, someone who popped when I watched the Cougars in the Alamo Bowl is Hakeem Butler, who's jumping up into the NFL in the junior year. Is he someone, he's a big target on the outside for Iowa State. Is he someone who fits into that late second day, early third day?
Yeah, that's the kind of range he's going to go in. And, you could list off about 10 names who are going to go in that range. But it's really deep in that position. The thing about Hakeem Butler is he's got the same problem that N'Keal Harry's got at Arizona State, who a lot of people put in the first round. I don't think he's going to go in the first round now. And that separation, you actually watch them. And that game that you're talking about, that was probably the best kind of separation I've seen him have. I've seen a lot of his games this year where he's winning a lot of contested catches. He's not got an amazing explosive break. So he's not creating separation in the routes. He's having to win with his size. It's often throw it to the sideline and he'll go up and make a play over a much shorter cornerback. And when you get to the NFL level, you're going to need a little bit more than that. You are going to have to win with speed. You are going to have to be able to separate. You are going to have to be very savvy in your routes. You have to be subtly a little shove of the defensive back, get yourself open. And of all the positions in college football to sort of assess, receiver is one of the easiest ones. Because when you watch Mike Evans playing for Texas A&M, he's going to be top 10 pick. When you watched Odell Beckham, you thought, this guy's amazing. When you watched Jarvis Landry, you thought, this guy's amazing. There was lots and lots of players over the years that you've just watched, you think they're going to be special. You could even see actually watching someone like Sammy Watkins, he looks good, but I'm not sure. And it's funny how it's probably the easiest position to scout college football in terms of translating to the NFL. Just watch if they get open. Watch what they do off the step. Watch how they separate from whether it's a deep route or if it's just sort of a slant inside. Watch how they separate. And that's the problem that Butler and N'Keal Harry and others have got. And it's one of the reasons why I really like people like Marquise Brown. They get open. The guys at Ohio State are just so fast, so explosive, that I would look more down that road than some of these bigger, more lumbering, yes, they're going to jump great verticals, but no, they're not particularly fast and twitchy athletes that we're going to see in the middle rounds.
One area of the team, sorry, Stu, that certainly does deserve, needs a lot of work, I would say, is special teams. I mean, Janikowski's kicked 3 buzzer-beating, for want of a better term, kicks to take you from, whereas last year Blair Walsh missed 3 of them that could have been a 2 or 3 game swing. Janikowski, I presume, is completely done. I mean, that hamstring injury did not look too good. But in addition to that, I think punt return and kickoff return is kind of just a nothing for us at the minute. There's going to be players in free agency around there, but are there any wide receivers out there that you could double up as your lead punt returner? Because I don't really think Tyler Lockett has shown that much this year to say that it's worth risking probably your third or fourth highest player on that position anymore.
The problem with college football is that they have such deep rosters, and anybody can go out there, that often the very best players and the ones that are going to make in the NFL are not always out there necessarily covering kicks. So it's sometimes difficult to see. I mean, someone like Chauncey Garner-Johnson, who's he's kind of the nickel slash safety that they had at Florida, had a really good game against Michigan. You can find some evidence of him covering kicks, but on a lot of other players, they're just not doing it. So it's a difficult one. I mean, the players, you'll always know when a player is good on special teams because it will always get mentioned by people who sort of assess that, because they'll have seen them actually doing it and they'll go, oh yeah, that was that really good moment there. So I think the biggest problem the Seahawks had there in terms of the coverage is twofold. One, the depth is not good enough on this roster. I mean, we saw that in preseason when they lost every single game. I mean, we used to see in the Seahawks of 2011, 12, 13, 14 were so deep that their sort of reserve roster would have beaten some teams in the NFL. It was that strong. The backups would have won actual regular season games. And then when you see this year in preseason, it was an eye-opener. And people who were at training camp said the depth is not good. That translates to special teams. Unless you're going to put your starting guys out there time and time again, which they have done in the past, Earl Thomas and Richard Sherman were big special teams guys. Unless you're going to do that, then you're going to you run the risk of it being sort of the dregs of your roster. You're relying on them to be good at special teams. Then the other thing that happened is that Seahawks had a lot of injuries, and they were asking, and Pete Carroll noted this, I think, after the Arizona game, that you've got someone like Delano Hill, who's been on special teams all year. And then in his mind, he's having to get his head straight to start safety as well. And he's still having to do the special teams duties because they see him as a key special teamer. And in that Arizona game, as well as the other thing, is that Nico Thorpe was, I think, was if he was involved a little bit more, maybe. I'm trying to remember. There was a game where this happened, where one of the cornerbacks got hurt and he was thrust into it a little bit more. And again, in your head, you're going into the game thinking, what's my role on special teams? I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to do the other. And then all of a sudden you start in and you've got a whole different set of responsibilities on your mind as well. And it can impact the team. And I think that was part of the issue there, but it's certainly an area they have to improve. It was really bad at the end of the year. Janikowski, you know, he just looked like it was tough to watch the man hobble off after that kick. And what a sad end. If that is the end of his career, but it is a sad way to go out getting hurt with a kick. I almost kind of wonder whether he wouldn't have it any other way. Actually, he kind of seems like that kind of guy. But they need to find a somewhat long term solution there. Now, look, the Niners played a blinder because Robbie Gould was shockingly cut by the Chicago Bears a few years ago. How they wish they had him this week. He was shockingly cut a few years ago, and the Niners capitalized, took him, and he's been Mr. Consistent for them. He just gets the kicks he's expected to get, and that's really it. And I think that's what the Seahawks need. They need to, I think he may even be a free agent in the offseason. They've got to go and find somebody who can just go out there, nail the 45-yard kicks and all the extra points. Jobs are good, and that's what they need to do. And someone will do it for 2 or 3 years because they can't be doing this every year and changing it.
Well, when they couldn't afford Hauschka for, you know, on that $3 or $4 million a year deal with the salary cap, that shouldn't really be an issue now. So there should be a bit more flexibility to pay him now, no, Stu?
I think so, but I think kickers appears, what Pete Carroll said the other day, it appears quite low on the list of priorities with terms of free agency and stuff like that. It seems, as always, seems to be a lot about keeping their own rather than outside first, doesn't it, Rob?
Yeah, but I think that they've got to do, I think Adam's right, they've got to go and spend a bit of money here now and sort this out and just go and get the best, most accomplished kicker on the market. Now, it's possible that these guys may get, if I was the Niners, for example, I'd think about franchising Robbie Gould because just keep him. I mean, if you were worried about that, just keep him, because I imagine the franchise tag's not that high for a kicker. He's securing for another year. You've got a bajillion dollars to spend in free agency anyway, in cap space. So it's not going to matter that you franchise your kicker. I'd think about doing that. But if he was to hit the market, or if there were two or three experienced, proven kickers out there that are on the market, I'd say, yeah, look, come and play for us for 2 or 3 years and we'll pay you handsomely.
It's too important to not forget about it.
Yeah. Especially with the way that they play, like they keep it tight. The kicking game is really important. They emphasize the importance of special teams more than a lot of other teams. Pete Carroll keeps talking about completing the circle. They need to rely on their kicker. So go and make sure that we're not talking about this for the next 2 or 3 years. Just go and get a really accomplished kicker. If you have to pay him $3.5-4 million a year, just do it. You've got the cap space, and then you can just forget about it.
If it is it for Janikowski, he finishes 10th all time in field goal made and total points scored with 1,913 points. And he's also, Rob, probably going to be the last ever kicker to be a first round pick, isn't he?
Yes. I keep forgetting that that's a fact. I mean, just imagine the thought of big old Sebastian Janikowski
17th going overall, in the first round.
17th overall. Imagine if that happened today.
Hello.
Imagine the reaction. Imagine
Do you think Seahawks Twitter would rather take a kicker or a running back in the first round next year?
It depends what the EPA is, I guess.
That's true. But yeah, I mean, it's funny also, because we missed the field goal and we lost by 2 points. I mean, no one's ever going to remember the score. It's one of those games where no one will ever remember the score because it's such a weird one. You know, I know that in not having a kicker, we did two-point conversions successfully. But we lost by 2 points and missed the field goal.
Yeah.
I think the crushing thing, if you'd have just stopped that darn 3rd and 14, yeah. I mean, you sort of sat there watching and thinking, hey, look, because they think they threw on one of the downs early on, it may even be the down before that, which stopped the clock because it was incomplete. And you're thinking, they've given the Seahawks too much time here. You know, they're going to run here, but then the Seahawks are going to have ample time to get down and score if they need it. And for it to happen like that, like if you'd thrown it to Amari Cooper who made this most amazing catch or something, then you'd say, oh, God, fair play, you know, that's what they brought him in for. But for Dak to just kind of saunter his way through and 2 missed tackles and not even have the chance to do it was the hardest thing. That's the hardest takeaway I'll have from that. Yeah. Just stopped him a yard short. They kicked the field, even a yard, if he just got 13 yards, he kicks the field goal and the Seahawks at least have that one last chance to pull it out. And with the way that Wilson was throwing the ball downfield, who knows, he probably would have done it.
Yeah, on the defense in particular, obviously on Sunday, do you think some of the flack that Schottenheim is getting, obviously indirectly via Pete Carroll, do you think Ken Norton is dodging the bullet somewhat with that, with how those big players kind of went last when he's in the same situation as Schottenheim? Because obviously Pete Carroll is a defensive coach, he's a defensive backs coach, so it's his defense, but Ken Norton's the face of it, but it just doesn't seem to be any mention of his name in the same level of distaste and distrust to Schottenheimer, Rob.
Well, nobody's complaining about the defense. Nobody's even mentioning it. And look, the defense played well for the most of the game. I mean, you could easily highlight some of the great plays that they had, some of the three and outs that they had. Yeah, and they, you know, what was it? They conceded 10 points after three quarters. You know, you have to give them credit for that. But they just had some back-breaking situations. The run from Zeke Elliott. Yes, that was a poor moment from one of the two cornerbacks. I don't know who was responsible. They were both there, Akeem King and Shaquille Griffin. One of them needed to contain and not allow Zeke to get outside. You know, that was a very conservative play by Dallas with time running out, a 3rd and 1. It was kind of just get the first down, maybe clock it, and we'll work from there. Very conservative. Even if they convert that there, you're kind of very comfortable in that situation with them. I think they were just inside their own half. And yet it ends up being a 40-yard play or 50-yard play. I mean, it's just incredible. You can't give that up. The two drives in the fourth quarter, you know, the one that get Dallas, and as soon as the Seahawks gone 14-10 up, that's a momentum shift. They snatched it straight back with a quick-fire score themselves, and there was no resistance really from the Seahawks defense. And then that final drive, two pass interference calls on third down, the Dak run on 3rd and 14, It cost them the game as much as anything else did, and nobody's talking about it. And whether that's Carroll you point the finger at, or the defensive coordinator, or the players, I don't know. But the reason why nobody's talking about those things is simply because Seahawks Twitter has decided to buy fully into this analytics style. You know, there are people that are very aggressive in the way they talk about it. They badger you to death about this topic. That they're relentless with it. That this is the only way to play. This is, if you're not playing this way, then you're not doing it right. And a lot of people have bought into that. And Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer are not buying into it. And because of that, there's this opposition here. So no one's talking about the defense. It's all about the offense and the philosophy and the style, because that's the thing they want to talk about forever and a day. And it's a bit tiring and a bit frustrating, but it does mean that we are missing some other aspects of this game that cost the Seahawks win, including the defense.
Yeah.
It's funny that about the because one touch on that doesn't even get mentioned at all is the one to Gallup, which was a great throw. But I think it was 3-all with about 3 minutes left in the first half. And I text Stu saying, right, we're going to have back-to-back possessions here to end this half and start the second half. And I reckon that'll be us. We'll win. And all of a sudden, from 3-all, when I thought it was back-to-back possessions, we ended up being 10-6 down after those, what I thought were two possessions, because we kicked the field goal too quickly, and then, you know, they just marched straight down the field and scored a touchdown. And yeah, I think, you know, you're bang on in the sense that it's just an area that people have decided to just glaze over completely, because, you know, that touchdown, I think that it couldn't have taken more than a minute off the clock for them to get from back to front there.
And can I admit to something here that towards the end of halftime, I actually went to make a cup of tea. And by the time they'd made the tea and got back to the living room, this was towards the end of half time. I thought I had time to do this. The Seahawks were punting for the first possession of the second half. I'd not even seen, they'd done it, they'd gone three and out so quickly that I'd missed the whole three plays and sort of coming back expecting to, right, come on, you know, get started, get a touchdown going here, you know, get a scoring drive going. They were already kicking it back to Dallas. So, yeah, that was kind of a, I think I probably knew at that moment there that it wasn't going to be our day.
Yeah. Also, one more thing on defense. Did KJ Wright make himself some money and possibly keep himself in Seattle with how he played on Sunday? Because he made a big impact. Obviously, the interception was the standout play, but he just seemed to be in there a lot more than you see the Calitros and other Barkevious Mingos of the world in on the rim plays, Rob.
He definitely made himself some money. I just don't think it's going to be in Seattle, unfortunately. I think that I think the Seahawks would love to have KJ Wright back. I think that if they could guarantee that, then they would love to have him. I think the players have a huge amount of respect for him. Look how Ken Norton's been saying sort of KJ's back. KJ back has been sort of his like catchphrase for the last since he came back. And Pete Carroll clearly has a lot of respect for the guy, and he's done everything right. You know, while others have complained about the contracts and money and stuff like that, he's just got his head down and played through and done been at everything, every OTA. He is a great role model. He is doing some charity work, I think, in this off-season, isn't he, in Africa? Isn't he building a well? I mean, it's just everything about the guy is amazing. But the problem is that there are going to be teams. He's probably going to reach the open market, and there are going to be teams out there with a lot of cap space who are going to say, we don't care that he was injured last year. We'll take a chance at him because we've got the cap room. Because even if he sits out the whole year injured or even 2 years injured, we can eat it. It's fine because we've got $120 million to spend. So I'm thinking of teams like the Colts and teams like the 49ers are going to say, who play similar defenses to Seattle. They're going to say, we'll take a chance on this guy because he's an amazing player, great talent, great leader. He can help establish things in the locker room and we'll take the chance on his health. So we'll pay the guy. So I actually think he's probably going to get more money than people think on the open market when he reaches that. And the Seahawks are going to have a number in the mind. And I think it's going to get blown out the water. And they're just going to have to say, there's nothing we can do about it. And you're going to have to let him move on, which is, for me, it's a shame. I'd really like to see him come back. But I think that people think that they assume that he's just not going to get any money on the market and there's going to be ice cold. And I actually think the opposite. I mean, I might be wrong, but I think the opposite will happen. I think that teams will be willing to pay him probably what Thomas Davis got. As a mid-30-something linebacker. I mean, Cage is about 29, 30. I think they will probably pay him because he is such a great leader, is such a great character, is a good player, as he showed in that playoff game yesterday. So I think he will move on, but it won't be because the Seahawks want it to happen. And I think they will end up, you know, assuming he's not in jail, I think they will bring back Michael Kendricks probably on a one-year deal. And he will end up taking KJ's place.
What a sentence that is.
What a sentence.
Just so people can quantify, you know, listen to this that aren't exactly sure, you know, cap space and whatever. I heard a guy on the radio who I really don't like at all say that KJ might get like 2-year, $19 million deal, and I scoffed at that. Is that the kind of money you reckon he might get on the open market?
No,
it just seems very high.
I'm trying to think what Thomas Davis got. Thomas Davis got something like, I think it was 2 years at 16. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I think it was. And a lot of it was front loaded, I think. So that's the kind of thing I'm thinking of here, that maybe he will get a couple of years at maybe $8 million a year, which is not enough. You know, we're talking, hey, listen, it's 10 plus for a good linebacker these days. So eight for KJ. And I think some teams, well, if you've got it, like the Colts have got to find a way. There's a minimum cap spend as well as an actually, you know, a limit. You've got to find some people to spend money on. And KJ Wright's exactly the type of player for me that you actually end up doing that with, because he's a very safe player. And if it doesn't work out because of the injuries, you'll probably eat it because it's not actually going to cost you. It's not going to cost you another player because you've got so much cap space. So I think people will be willing to take a chance on having his leadership and his quality on their roster. And I think the Seahawks are going to get, it's a crying shame. I really like to see him back. I don't know what you guys think, but I do think he's going to move on. And I think they're going to just look at Michael Kendricks and say, all being well, obviously legally, that they can probably get him back for a fraction of that cost. He probably will want to come back because he'll see the Seahawks, you know, paid him a lot of respect by giving him the chance to play while this was going on. And he played well. So I think that he will end up taking KJ's place as the experienced linebacker on the roster. I would still quite like them to to add somebody else as well. They've been promising to add a new young linebacker for a number of years now, and it hasn't really happened, you know, not with any real investment there. So I think it's about time they got some youth and speed at that position, especially when you're playing teams like the Rams twice a year.
Yeah. So I think before Sunday, before Saturday, I didn't see much of a wake. He just kind of sounded like and appeared like his body was starting to break down. But after Sunday, yeah, I'd be all for keeping him around. I don't know about you, Adam.
Well, I got basically every view I had on the off-season moves last year were completely wrong, which probably says I probably really shouldn't be hosting a Seahawks podcast. I'm going to say that, to be honest. But I was disappointed like when they let go of guys like last year, like Luke Wilson and Deshaun Shedd, who I just thought were good Seahawks guys. And that's probably been proven, you know, I've probably been proven wrong in the end. But someone like KJ Wright, as you say, if you can keep him in the building, even as just a guy to pull people in the right place and teach guys how to be good pros. I mean, I'm just thinking, we were talking about the Colts, you know, what a great coach for Darius Leonard that could be for 2 years, just even if he's next to him for half the games and telling him what to do for the other half. You know, a player like that could be invaluable to a roster. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think having seen them on Sunday and just watching quite how much better he was than Kalitro and Mingo, if the money's there and it works, I think I'd be all for keeping him.
Can I just add that Thomas Davis's current contract, bear in mind that he is 35. It's 1 year, nearly $7 million.
Wow. Okay.
So that's, you know, and KJ Wright, if there is a market, I mean, unless teams have just go, no thanks, which I'd be shocked if that's the case, his agent will be turning around to teams and going, well, Thomas Davis is on seven, so you want to give us more than that, because he's 29. So I do think... Look, I know that the narrative has been that he won't get paid and that's it, but I just don't think the Seahawks are going to commit $8 to $10 million to him because they've lived through the injuries. They've probably got more intel on the knee injury. They're a bit tighter on the cap than someone like the Colts, who've got the most in the NFL. And as you said, what a partner for Darius Leonard. What a duo that would be. Yeah. And the Colts could give him flipping $12 million, really. It doesn't matter. They've got $120 million to spend. And if it's only a two-year deal, it's not that massive commitment to KJ anyway, so I think it makes a lot of sense for him to go to someone like the Colts or hopefully not the 49ers or somebody like that.
Yeah. Two more things on linebacker position. I said on this podcast, I said to Adam numerous times last few weeks that I don't think Shaquem Griffin makes his team next year because I think he's had 53 snaps all season and 45 of them came in week one in Denver. Do you see him on this roster next year, Rob?
It's a hard one to judge. I mean, the problem with Shaquem is that I, even going into the draft, I always kind of felt, I wrote a lot of articles about this, that he was going to be a special teams dynamo and a possible situational linebacker, and that was his sort of ceiling, and never really saw him as an eventual starting linebacker. So if he has a special teams preseason to end all special teams preseasons, then he'll be on the roster. Mm. If he doesn't manage that and others have good years in special teams, sadly, his time is going to be limited. And the problem with Shaquem is he's never going to be a starter for me, and he was exposed against Denver. And everything that you would think that we identified as an issue at UCF as a starting linebacker showed up in that Denver game. You know, you're sort of translating to what he was going to be at the pros. It was the bad run defense. They were targeting him in the run game. It was, he can't really drop in zone properly. And I don't think those issues are ever going to... I would have liked to have seen them blitz him a little bit more and get after the quarterback. The one thing he did really well at UCF was spy and get after the quarterback and get a load of sacks and TFLs, and he didn't really ever do that for the Seahawks this year, which makes me think that maybe they don't see that as a role for him, and if that's not a role for him, then he's really just limited to a special teams guy. So if other people outperform him on special teams, then you're right.
Yeah, and the other thing on linebacker is the name I've been... send into Adam, I think, since we watched season two of Last Chance U, is Dakota Allen out of Texas Tech. Would he be someone who fits the bill for Seahawks at linebacker?
I've not seen him play, so I'll have to go and check him out if you recommend him as a really cool guy.
Great
so
yeah, to
I'll
watch.
Go and, I'll definitely go and have a look at that. The one thing that I really want, at this time of year, I just want to get the combine out of the way because I want to see who the fastest guys are and the most explosive guys. And I want speed at linebacker. I want someone who can run a really good 40-yard dash and has got a great short shuttle and is explosive. And I want the Seahawks to go and draft them. I know the D line as well, by the way. I think they need speed across that front seven. They're going to have to do it if they're going to stop these sweeps from the Rams and all this freaky stuff that they do. They're going to need some speed there, and I want to get a fast linebacker who's intense and hits. So let's go and find who it is.
So yeah, and also we saw that on Sunday with Alvie and Jalen, didn't we? Really, the speed at that linebacker position. Adam?
I was going to talk about the defensive line, funnily enough, coming into free agency. I think if you'd maybe said 4 years ago you'd sent someone away to a spaceship and come back and said, in 4 years' time, which combination of Seahawk players would have had 25 sacks combined, you would never have thought it would be Clark and Reed. And I wonder if we're seeing a kind of a slight difference in defensive style whereby they're letting guys, go after the quarterback a bit more. I always used to personify, the way we used to play defense as, it's a lot about gap contain, and if you can get your sack, you do it. But they seem to be a lot more aggressive in how they've got after the quarterback this year, not with blitzing, but just in the individual scheme. And might that be an inkling that they could go out and spend big money on someone like a Tank Lawrence or a Clowney if they're not franchise tagged? Because, a couple of years ago, I would have almost thought it might be a waste because they're not going to let them really play to their maximum, level.
I think it's a great observation based on what they did this year, because it's not something I really thought about, but it's really made me think that I think you've got a point there. I think they probably felt like they had to be a little bit more aggressive. Maybe in the past they felt like, hey, do you know what? If we get it to third down and we take away the running game, we've got Averill and Bennett and we've got Frank Clark or Chris Clemens, and those guys will get after the quarterback. And they probably felt a lot more confident just shutting down those early downs and being a very conservative. And maybe this year they thought, hey, we can't rely on that anymore. Jaron, you've got a bit more permission to, don't just focus on covering that gap. You can go and attack and pass rush. And Frank, you do this. And maybe that's one of the reasons why the run defense was so sloppy in some games as well, because they were a bit more aggressive. So I think it's a very good point. I think in terms of spending money, I don't think they're going to have anywhere near enough money to go after, guys like that. I mean, they've got about $60 million at the moment. They'll create a bit more if they will part ways with Cam Chancellor at some point. They save quite a lot if they move Jaron Brown and Barkevious Mingo. They can save a lot of money there. But they have the least number of players in the entire NFL signed up on their roster for 2019, which means that they've got more work to do than any other team in the league to fill out their roster, which is an issue. And it will be an issue for comp picks as well, because they're going to have to do that. So they're going to have to re-sign a lot of guys. Obviously, Frank Clark's probably going to get the franchise tag, so that wipes off $18 million right off the bat. They're going to have to see what they're going to do with a load of exclusive rights free agents and restricted free agents that they've got. They're going to have to find ways to keep a lot of them. There are other guys that presumably would consider keeping, like Justin Coleman. What do they do with him? Do they let him hit the market? Do they feel confident replacing him after all? They did just sort of get him as a bit of spare change from a Cassius Moss trade. And they're going to have to consider what they do with J.R. Sweezy and DJ Fluker as well, and how much they're going to be expected to get. So if they can get really great cheap deals, all these guys, then yeah, maybe they will have a bit of money to spend. But I think what's more likely is a very conservative approach similar to last year, where the second and third wave, and they look for the value. The good thing is there's sort of two sides to this. It is an amazing defensive line draft coming up. This is going to be the defensive line draft class, the end-all defensive line draft classes. We might see 10 or 12, 15 go in the first round. It is loaded on defensive linemen. That might impact the way that teams approach free agency. And some of these, the bigger names are going to get paid. Frank, Lawrence, Clowney, if they're not franchise tag, are going to get paid. The second tier might find that teams are unwilling to pay them big money because they know that they can wait for the draft. So that could provide for example, is Anthony Barr going to get a huge deal? Or is he going to be left in a situation where he's leaving Minnesota and he's looking at a Michael Bennett situation from 2013, or even Cliff Avril, where he's taking a 1 or 2 year deal to try and go somewhere else and have a go at that? I mean, that's something to consider. What about someone like Tyrell Suggs, who seems like he might be leaving Baltimore? Can you get him on a 1 year deal? What about Clay Matthews? Is there an opportunity to get some pass rush into the team one way or another at a cost? And I think that's something they have to look at. I think they need a run defender in the Tony McDaniel style. Got to go and find him. Could be a priority. Is there anybody in the secondary that they'd like to add? Is there this year's answer to Bradley McDougal out there that they can add there that can offer some playmaking quality? These are the things, but I'm not expecting massive splash. I'm thinking second and third wave value.
One name you... Do you think Ed Dixon could be a name who could be sacrifice for some moves like that. Because obviously, he played like 20 snaps on Saturday night. He hasn't really done much since he came off, apart from a couple of touchdown catches. Do you think with the emergence of Will Disley before he took the field in week 5 or 6, do you think he could be someone who could be sacrificed for fit into that?
Very possibly, and again, there's sort of two answers to this as well. I mean, I suppose the one thing, Will Disley's injury maybe makes him a little bit more secure, because they don't really know how Will's going to come back and whether he's going to be able to start straight away. That's one point to it. I suppose, on the other hand, you could say I think it's a bit of an overrated tight end draft coming up, but there are a lot of names and we have to sort of see how they test. You know, I need to watch a bit more tape on some of them, but you might see 6 tight ends going in the second round. There's going to be a rush probably in the 40s, I would say, where you see a lot of tight ends probably coming off the board, assuming they all declare. I think there's only one left at Hockenson at Iowa's not confirmed whether he's going to turn pro or not. So, there's going to be a rush on tight ends, but there's a bit of depth sort of going through the rounds. So if they see somebody like Will Disley, and if they trade down and get a few more picks, I think they'll probably trade down twice and get up to 7 at least, then they may feel like if they can get another Will Disley type, you know, on day 3, then maybe after that they could cut Ed Dixon. But they'd have to go through the draft process first.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yep. So I think that's everything over the weekend, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah, I think there's 8 more months to ruminate on it, and I think we've probably done enough for one show on it.
Yeah, right. So a few weeks ago, we posted on Twitter and Facebook, open up the first ever voting for the first ever pedestrian podcast player of the year. And with over 50% of the votes from you guys, this guy was the man who we are naming as our podcast player of the year for 2018.
I feel like that's more of the outside. You know, I feel like it's always been, you know, it starts up front, you know, with us. You know, you got to get the plays, you got to get the call. Yeah, they had the name and, you know, they got a lot of the attention, and now the attention may shift to the linebackers. But, you know, we pride ourselves on being the guys that lead this team. And so that's been my mindset since I stepped here and, you know, had Coach Norton teach me the way. And, you know, it's always been about the guy in the middle. So, for me, it's not no different, because that's how I looked at it. But from the outside, maybe it is different, because those guys are gone and, you know, you guys are looking for someone who's going to be that leader. Y'all ain't got to look. Like, y'all looking at the guy right here. I will be that guy, and, you know, we're going to be fine.
It is blocked as a flag comes down, and it was Bobby Wagner. Who else? Is intercepted by Bobby Wagner. Only the quarterback to defend. Bobby Wagner with a touchdown.
How you think you got NFC player of the week?
I'm just saying, I had to get a pick 6 in front of you.
Wow.
I wanted to put you to sleep.
You look slow.
Well, y'all can't catch me, so what's that say about you?
I was damn near about to run out.
If I'm slow, you slow.
I was about to go out.
If I'm slow, you slow.
I was about to go get you.
Well, you should have did it, because if it was you, my legs are strong.
Wait.
Like Joseph Stalin.
So, yeah, number 54, Bobby Wagner, got way over 50% of the votes. Clear winner in our listeners' eyes. Adam, do you agree with what are the people listening to this and people who voted, UK Seahawkers voted for number 54, Adam?
Well, I was one of the voters that did that, so I guess I have to agree with it. I think it's probably fairly clear-cut that it was either him or Wilson, probably are the two guys that I would say were the standout candidates. Obviously, Frank Clark was great, but I think if you're going to say, you know, quarterback aside, because the quarterback's obviously always hugely important, but if there was one guy on the team you thought, you know, if we lose this guy, we are absolutely stuffed, I think that was Wagner, and I think his play was, again, exceptional. I don't think he missed a tackle all season, and he was exceptional all year and fully deserving of our hugely prestigious award.
Yeah, so he finished the year with 138 combined tackles, one sack, six tackles for loss, eight quarterback hits, one football recovery, 11 pass defense, and obviously the one pick six against the Niners. Do you agree with the player of the year being number 54, Rob?
Well, it'd be a bit harsh to deny him the award. I mean, he's had a great year. He's been sensational again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very difficult question, actually. I didn't really know who you were going to go with because, you know, as Adam kind of mentioned, Russell Wilson had a great year, Clark, Tyler Lockett. But Bobby was, you know, immense. So, what a great year he had, and he fully deserves the honour.
Yeah, he with all the departures and obviously the absence of Earl Thomas through injury, he has kind of stepped up into that defensive leader breach if he wasn't already there, hasn't he, Rob, this year?
Yeah, he has. I mean, I think that's really sort of shone through. That's one of the big things in the year, that he really has taken that on and feels like it's his defense now. And you can see sort of Jaron Reed and Frank Clark emerging as fellow leaders of this group, and Bradley McDougal too. But, you know, it's Bobby's defense. And yeah. I'm in a fantasy league with a few other journalists and mentioned a year ago that Bobby Wagner was underrated, and they all laughed and said that it was a ridiculous thing to say, that he was, you know, he was in the Pro Bowl every year and how could he be underrated? And they weren't listening to my argument, but the point was really that I don't think people quite appreciate on an international level just how good he is to have been this consistent for so long. He's avoided injuries. He has been a pillar of consistency. His players rarely ever dropped. And he has just got better and better every single year. I think that he is a legitimate Hall of Fame candidate one day. And I think it's time that more people sort of considered him one of the great defensive players of the last 10 years rather than just a really good linebacker.
Yeah, he is, for me, the best linebacker on the planet, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you say that, Rob. I mean, I feel like Luke Kuechly could not play for the next 3 years, and he'd be in the Pro Bowl in 2023, just because that's the way people, you know, is that linebacker? Well, that's Luke Kuechly, you know, out the window, it's open and shut case, Luke Kuechly. And Wagner's kind of suffered as a result of that just general lazy analysis. But, you know, I guess maybe everyone watches their own team a little bit closer, but I don't think you need to watch too closely to see quite how good and impactful Wilson is. And actually, I think someone that's championed that is Brian Baldinger, who we talk about quite a lot on this podcast, is someone that does excellent breakdowns, and he's been a big fan of Wagner all year, which have been very pleasing to see.
So for 2018 on the events, which obviously a lot of it's gone through Russell Wilson, 35 passing touchdowns in the regular season for Russell Wilson. So who is there any surprises on the offensive side of the ball for you, Adam, in 2018?
Well, I thought Tyler Lockett was signed too quickly. I thought they were hasty in offering him the contract, and I have no problem in freezing cold taking myself. I just didn't think I'd seen enough to legislate giving him that kind of money. And I still think that there's times where I wish he was a 9-10 target guy, but you look at the stats he's put up this year, and it's pretty difficult to argue that they made 100% the right decision.
Yeah, Rob, on Lockett and your surprise on the offense?
Yeah, Lockett had a fantastic year. I mean, I think when he got his contract, I didn't have an issue with it, but it was one of those whereby you're like, okay, well, you know, they've paid him a lot of money. Let's see how that goes. And then he's been amazing. A surprise on the offense. I think the surprise for me is the offensive line. And I know that we've talked about it's had some issues on pass protection still. To have spent a whole season not having the whole Seahawks fan base complaining endlessly about the O-line, and to have sort of the national media folks making constant jokes about the offensive line, for that reason alone has been an enjoyable year for that. To not have to have that as a laughing stock unit. So I would say that was sort of the big surprise, the fact that they really did turn a corner there after a couple of years of shambolic O-line play.
Yeah, I mean, for someone who was on his third team and kind of the first two teams made no real effort looking from the outside in, of keeping them. DJ Fluka is probably one of the biggest surprises of the year, isn't he, Adam? Just for the impact, not just on the field, but off the field. Another one who seems immensely popular, especially in that O-line room, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken to Michael Sean Dugar a lot, and he said, you know, Fluka has been one of the leaders in the locker room. And, you know, for the amount of money that we are paying, I mean, accountability is, it's been a bit of a cliche, but it's one of the things that has been talked about a lot this year as a thing that had to change. And I think bringing someone like Fluka, who will hold people to account if they're not doing the right things, and I think it was imperative. And I don't think it's any surprise that Efedi has had better performances with Fluka inside, next to him. Because it's a guy just to pull him around and say, you know, do this, do that, and whatever. I don't think it's any surprise that that's worked out as a hugely successful move, especially in the run game.
Yeah. Rob, Fluka?
Yeah, I actually had a chance to interview him after the London game, and that was fun. I mean, just a great laugh, you know, to be around him. You know, he's just a hilarious character. You know, the things that he says, huge smile. Absolute mountain of a bloke. I've never seen anybody quite like him. He was only wearing a towel at the time, which was an experience. A real force as a run blocker. And I hope he stays. You know, I know people say, oh, he's been a few injuries, but I don't kind of care. You know, the O-line was good for the first time in a few years, or good at least at run blocking. So I want to see that retained. I want to see him and Sweezy back. This group seems to have a connection and driving some of the attitude, and for a few games the Seahawks did seem to have that sort of bully spirit back. They might not have the LOB anymore, but they had a running game that people didn't want to play against, so I hope they're back next year.
Yeah, and one of the clips of the season is him running Ndamukong Suh into the ground, isn't it, against the Rams.
Yeah, and then I think he sort of referred after it was like a couple of bears in the woods or something. He said, to the water or something.
Any disappointments on the offensive side of the ball? Adam?
I don't think anyone massively kind of underperformed on what we thought they were. I mean, David Moore, maybe you thought you might have seen a little bit more from him in the last 6 weeks, but I don't really think anyone's been a huge, you know, let down at all, really, on either side of the ball. You know, people have been nitpicking at Shaq Griffin. I think that's a little bit kind of have a take in order to have a take stuff, which is no surprise given the people that we follow on social media. I don't know. When the dust has settled of being, you know, upset about defeat, I don't think you can look at this season as anything but a great success and something to look forward to for next year.
Yeah, Rob?
I think the only, I mean, this is only like a personal sort of disappointment, is I kind of wish that Penny had a little bit more success than he did. I mean, he had some really nice plays during the year and some memorable plays and some explosive plays, but it would have been nice to have seen a little bit more from him. So that one, I do get a sense that as the off season drags on, and it will drag, that more and more people will continue to split hairs on why they spent that pick a year ago. We're probably going to have a whole bunch of funny guys on Twitter saying, oh, they're going to take a running back in round one again this year, you know, which would be hilarious when you've heard that 7,000 times. So I kind of wish that he'd done a little bit more just for the purposes of maybe quietening some of that. And giving us all a lot of confidence that, hey, they've got Carson and they've got Penny guaranteed next year that they can really rely on. Still a question mark with Penny going into next year. And I wish that wasn't quite the case. It is. Yeah. You have to live with it. But I still also think that people are a bit too quick to judge rookies, and that sometimes a rookie just needs to have a bit of time to settle into the league.
Yeah, I'd agree. But I think, again, as I mentioned more about, it seems to be usage a lot with him. He didn't seem to get on the field enough to make an impact. I mean, he ended just under 5 yards a carry, which isn't too bad, but when he only gets the ball, 70, 80 times, he's not going to have much opportunity to make a massive impact. So defensively, surprises of the season, is it between Jaron Reed and Trey Flowers, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah, I think Trey Flowers is a great shout. Just because he was, I mean, I'm not just saying this to sound like I know what I'm talking about, but when you were watching the combine last year, and they were doing the safety drills, and it looked like a terrible class for safety. I mean, like the guy who was working out, you were just thinking, oh my God, what is this? Oh no, sorry, I've got it wrong. I've got that completely wrong. Sorry, I've misspoke. The cornerback class was terrible. The cornerbacks were terrible. You were watching the corners work out, and you were like, oh my word, what is this group? It was like Jair Alexander and a bunch of guys that just walked in off the street. I mean, it was terrible. It was a terrible workout. And then the safeties came out, and immediately this one guy stood out because he just looked like a Seahawks corner. He had the great long arms and legs. Yeah. Just looked so much like a Seahawks corner. And I wrote in my notes that this Trey Flowers looks like a Seahawks corner. And I started, when the seven-round mocks, we started putting him in on the day three, just for the, you know, the possibility that they would bring him in for that purpose. And they did. It was great. It was one of the few things we got right. And then and then to see him sort of come in and play well as he has, I think he's, it won its testament again to Pete Carroll's just unmatched ability to coach up defensive backs.
Yeah.
And what a backstory you've got there with that now, with all the guys he's brought through. And just great hope for the future with Trey, that he can go on from here. I mean, he didn't have an interception this year. You know, next year, can he track the ball a little bit more as well and start to become a playmaker? Because I do think the two of them, I thought the cornerbacks played fairly well for most of the year and didn't get beat over the top, which is the key for the defense. But
yeah,
you'd like to see him maybe track the ball a little bit better and start to get, you know, sort of 2, 3, 4 picks each a season, rather than, I think Griffin got two, didn't he, and Trey none.
Yeah.
I think it's worth giving a shout to McDougal as well. I mean, if I told you at the start of the year, when we already thought we weren't going to be that great, that Earl Thomas would go down in week 4 with a season-ending injury, and you didn't notice it that much, I'd say, in the middle, versus the year where he went down, you know, Aaron Rodgers torched them, Matt Ryan absolutely torched them. I think the way McDougal has organized that secondary, which is, you know, it's a ragtag of names that they've kind of pieced together, let's be honest, I think that deserves a heck of a lot of credit. And the impact he had for a guy that's earning like $3 million a year is pretty great.
Yeah, I think those two, and obviously Jaron Reed, who I mentioned, I think Jaron Reed being the double-figure sack guy in the NFL was something people had way down the list of when he came out of Alabama, Rob, wasn't it? I mean, he was just a run defender for a run defender, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I thought he was a first-round guy. I thought he was a top 20 guy because, as much as he was just a run defender at Alabama for the most part, you didn't see any quite as good as that. I mean, he would just sort of plant the anchor. He was like two enormous tree trunks for legs. They would just sort of stick in the ground, and he was immovable. He would handle double teams all the time like he was sort of just handling a child. I mean, it was just unbelievable the way that he played and seemed incredibly like he was going to go in the top 20. I mean, I think I had him at 16 to Detroit in my last mock draft that year. And he ended up lasting deep in, not just into the second round, but
50, deep, wasn't it? 50?
Yeah, deep into the second round. And then when the Seahawks went up for him, I was delighted. You know, what a great pick that was. And then starting off, he was, first year was kind of okay. Second year, a little bit better. And then this year, you know, with to have a defensive tackle get 10.5 sacks, that is a really difficult achievement. I think the fact that Donald got 20.5 has kind of muddied the water a little bit. I don't think people realize how difficult. It's, you know, you're in Geno Atkins territory here with 10.5 sacks. You know, people should be celebrating this a lot.
Yeah, it's the first time in 17 years that Seahawks defensive tackle has got double figure in sack. Last one was John Randall back in 2001, Rob, which kind of attests to that point.
It really sums it up. And look, I hope that it's a sign of things to come. I hope he can replicate this next year. I wonder what they're going to do with his contract, because he's got 1 year left. I think that it'd be the worst possible bargaining time to go and speak to him now, because he maybe will be asking for, you know, whatever Aaron Donald's on, you know, which he's obviously not going to get. So I wonder whether that's one that maybe they don't do in the off season unless they can find some common ground. Maybe it's something they do during the season. If you remember, they re-signed KJ Wright sort of like a month before the end of the season, I think in 2014. I think that might be a situation with Jaron Reed.
Yes. So disappointments on defensive side? Either? Rob? Adam?
I think it's too nitpicky. That there's no one for me that stands out that, you know, massively under me. There's been players that haven't been that great. You know, Austin Calitro is not Bobby Wagner, but Austin Calitro wasn't Bobby Wagner going into the season. So
no.
I kind of never like saying that someone's been bad if we don't expect them to be good in the first place.
I've got a couple of answers for this. So I think, I hate criticizing rookies, and I think it's terrible. And I think people judge them too early now. But I kind of got my hopes up on Rasheem Green a little bit during preseason that he would have been able to. Look, I'm not saying get 10 sacks or anything, but kind of got my hopes up that as the year went on, he might sort of grow into a role. And he actually was inactive in a lot of games towards the end of the year, wasn't even available to take the field. So,
I mean, grow is probably quite a good word to use for him, isn't it? Because he was classed as maybe a little bit undersized coming in the first place, wasn't he?
And he's still only 21 as well.
Yeah, and the feeling, going into the draft was that if he'd have gone back to USC, he could easily have been a top 10 pick this year, because he kind of had the athletic potential for that. I don't think it would have happened given all the defensive linemen who were actually going to be eligible for this draft now. I think he would have been on the outside looking in, but he played so well in preseason that you were kind of hoping that there would be some impact there, and actually he just kind of had an anonymous year, didn't he? Yeah. So not writing him off, not saying that he's not going to be any good, but was kind of hoping for a bit more than we got from him. And I think the other one is Deion Jordan. And look, he was very hurt. He was hurt at the start of the year. So you kind of you might give him a little bit of a pass for that. But the way that he played last year, there was kind of some, maybe, just maybe, he could live up to that third overall pick status for the Seahawks. The way that he played in when he was healthy last year, could he stay healthy? Could he play a full season? Could he actually show a lot of promise? And I just don't think we really saw enough in him to sort of believe in that he's going to be a feature going forward.
Yeah. So looking ahead to 2019 on the defensive side, especially, is the things look forward to on the defensive side is something or someone that isn't on the roster yet. Is that fair, Rob?
Well, I just think that for them to take the next step, they need to add more talent, and whether that is a playmaker or two in the secondary, or whether it's more pass rush and more speed.
Yeah.
I think, look, they can't do enough to help. They've basically got four guys with Frank Clark and Jaron Reed and Bobby Wagner and Bradley McDougal, who are very established. They've got younger guys like Shaq and Trey, who could end up being in that same bracket. And then hopefully some of the other sort of the role players, your Jacob Martins and your Rasheem Greens and whatnot, can really take a step forward. If they re-sign Michael Kendricks and he can stay healthy, I think there's every chance that he could become a key player. But then I want to see more speed on this defense. I want to see front seven speed, whether that's a linebacker who can really attack teams like the Rams, cut out some of these jet sweeps and play a really great role, whether it's an edge rusher who is going to complement Frank Clark and just have a great duo there. Look, the best teams in the league have multiple pass rushers. They don't just rely on one edge and they don't rely on one DT. They have guys who can rotate in. They have attack you from both sides. I want to see a pass rusher come in, at least one, if not two, who can come in and really... I'm used to seeing a team with Bennett, Averill and Clark or Clemens, you know? I want to see three guys again. Let's get back to that. And I'd like to see someone... I don't know what position it is. I don't know whether it's a free safety. I don't know whether it's a strong safety and McDougal's to free, or whether it's a nickel corner or an outside. I'd like to see a playmaker added somewhere in the secondary, somebody who can force some turnovers and make some plays. I don't know who that is. It's not a good draft for cornerbacks or safeties. There are guys like Landon Collins who are free agents. I'm not necessarily sure the Seahawks would go down that road, or whether the Giants would even allow it to happen, but it would be nice to see some talent added to the defensive backs. But that is one area that you've kind of got to trust Pete Carroll with.
So anything else on 2018, 2019, Adam?
I think we've chopped it all up. We've set the world to rights, and we're ready to go for next year.
Obviously, there's a long time to go. Obviously, combine, draft, free agency, and obviously then we've got to survive through four preseason games and training camp and everything. So there's a long way to go until probably, I think, September 8th or September 9th, the week one kicks off. But before we take our final breaths on the 2018 Seahawks season, let's jump back into the bin, shall we, Adam?
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly's an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
So yeah, this week's final 2018 version of Get in the Bin, I'm going to go, and I've been waiting all weekend to do this. Peter King can get in the bin. The same journalist who defended the fact that Darren Sharper, who's in jail, I think, for quite a long time for being a serial rapist over a number of years in a number of states and cities, he can still get in the Hall of Fame, but Antonio Brown is not an All-Pro because he offended Ben Roethlisberger, and it's just his need to be still relevant is quite impressive, embarrassing from when I started watching American football a decade or so ago. He was probably the go-to guy for a lot of people, but he's just becoming a bit of a the shadow of his former self, isn't he? He's just quite embarrassing, all that chat about Antonio Brown over the weekend, wasn't it, Adam?
I'll let Rob take this one.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Probably going to be my answer too, to be honest.
What do you make of all that? I mean, he's defender sharper and all that, and he just seems to be just clutching on for something, doesn't he, when he says that about AB?
I think sharper aside, I mean, just Antonio Brown is, to say he's not in your top 20 wide receivers on the season because he, you know, he's an idiot for not turning up to the last game, and that's indefensible. But, you know, again, it's just the problem with this NFL season. I don't know if it's just been me that's thought this, but this year more than anything, anyone with a voice has seemed to just be, the takes have to get hotter and hotter and hotter. And I don't know, I'm finding it almost quite draining. For the first time, I'm almost looking forward to the season to be finished just so that some of the takes can be wrapped up for a few months. Cause I'm finding it a little bit dull.
Yeah. Rob, anyone in the bin for you this week?
There are so many to choose from. I mean, I'm really tempted to put Cliff Kingsbury in the bin because he just looks so goddamn handsome. And he's 4 years older than me, and you know, he looks a lot better. So that's one option. I mean, there are various members of Seahawks Twitter I'd love to chuck in the bin.
They're on timeshare, you don't have to worry about that. They're permanent members.
Kind of feel like every time I come on and you ask me to put someone in the bin, it's Seahawks Twitter. So I think to go on the theme of Adam saying everybody's got to deliver hot takes, and I completely agree with that. And it's like the media types, and it is sort of the members of Seahawks Twitter now. It's almost like who can shout the loudest and say the most ridiculous thing that creates a reaction. But Peter Schrager said this week that Nick Foles is the most clutch quarterback that has ever played the game, and that he would take him over if he was going to take anybody, any quarterback ever in a playoff game or something, that he would take Nick Foles. And as much as I respect and appreciate the Nick Foles story and legend that is blossoming in Philadelphia, that's not right. That is too hot a take. And for that reason, plus he looks like he wears eyeliner, so he's getting in the bin.
Love it.
That shows you're usually pretty good, I think. The bits obviously good boy football. Adam, anything for you?
I'm going slightly controversial here, and hopefully no one will take offence. I was coming on this podcast, you know, ready. I had a great idea. I thought I've got something to tell Stu about. I think it's going to happen. And I think this time next year, you're going to see Lev Bell and Antonio Brown on the Raiders. And then I go on Twitter today, and Rob Staten has a mock draft where Antonio Brown is going to the Raiders. So Rob Staten, you got to get in the bin because you stole my bit before my own podcast. I was gutted. I thought I was the only one that was thinking, right, well, they've got three first round picks. They're not going to do anything better with them than give one of them to the Steelers, who would probably take one for Brown. They got loads of cap room, so Bell as well. Why not do it? And so, yeah, you've stolen my thunder. But it's worth discussing that because it was a good mock draft. And you had Brown potentially ending up in Las Vegas or maybe London. Who knows?
Yeah, well, I think it's a trade that makes a lot of sense because the Raiders clearly are just intent on making as many headlines as possible. Now, whether that's to generate interest ahead of the move or whatever, but Mike Mayock as a GM, John Gruden as a head coach, all of the trades during the year now, and having all these first-round picks, I think John Gruden has waxed lyrical about Antonio Brown many times or something when he's done the Monday Night Football, saying what an amazing player he is. And you can just see them, can't you? You know, it would, if the Steelers are ready to move on, the Raiders have got three first-round picks. It just makes too much sense, doesn't it, to toss one over to Pittsburgh with maybe a bit of change and bring Antonio to, like you say, wherever they're playing next year, San Diego, London, wherever.
I don't think it's that bad a move because, pretty short on talent, and I would say he's a surefire talent that you're going to get.
That it also feels like a Raiders move. Like, it feels like an old-school Al Davis type of Raider, doesn't he, Antonio Brown, how he's appears to be off the field and how he handles himself and presents himself. He kind of has that Raiders feel, doesn't he?
It it makes a lot of sense for a team, like you said, that have not got a lot of talent, that need some X-factor players to take the next step. They need to generate some interest as well. Plus, the other thing is that because he's contracted and a lot of the sort of the guarantees will be paid by Pittsburgh, it's not going to break the bank, which is another thing for Mark Davis, which is important. You know, it's not like they're going to have to bring him in and then sign him immediately to a six-year contract and guarantee him $60 million. He's already signed the deal with Pittsburgh, so they will have to eat some of the money to move him on, and that means it's less for the Raiders to pay. So for that reason, it's also a very reasonable trade to make, and one that I think, you know, I did mock it yesterday. I'm probably going to keep that one in there for the rest of the off season until it definitely can't happen, because it just seems to makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? You know, you can just see it happening.
Yeah, but what do you make of the Mayock move to GM in Oakland or for the Raiders?
I mean, fair play to the guy. I mean, I think that everybody, I've never met him, so I don't know, but everybody who has met him, who spoke afterwards, just says what a great guy he is. He clearly knows his stuff. I think he's very entertaining on the NFL Network. I mean, the number of hours that I've, you know, my wife would say wasted watching the Combine live broadcasts, and just, you know, it is quite hard to sort of sit there for 8 hours or whatever it is, just watching guys running around a bit. But having Rich Eisen and Mike Mayock in the booth talking you through it made it really watchable and listenable. Yeah. So it's actually going to be sad to watch the Combine without him being part of it, because he was such an entertaining force. Clearly knows his stuff, clearly respected in the league. And listen, there are a lot of GMs in this league that probably haven't, you know, I don't know what their qualifications are, other than the fact that they knew the right people or whatever, some of them. I wouldn't say Mike Mayock's any less deserving of a gig than probably any of them. So fair play to the guy. Give it a go.
Yeah, I don't think Adam's realised that means more Charles Davis on draft weekend as well, Adam.
Yeah, I'm going to watch it on mute, I think.
Well, here's the thing. Daniel Jeremiah will be able to tell us that one time that he was there when they drafted Haloti Ngata for the 7,000th time.
It could be worse. It could be Bucky Brooks.
Ex-Seal.
I know, but I mean, if we're talking about Twitter people that have gone downhill, but that's a whole show in itself. I mean, yeah. In talking of personnel, something that's just broken this evening, you might now rather be a Raiders fan than a Jet fan, because they just hired Adam Gase as their head coach.
Seen that.
So the AFC East are just trying to trade coaches, are they, between the three teams?
Yeah, it's does seem an interesting one. But again, we've probably got to keep things. Got to have conversations to discuss at some point in February. So we might keep that on for later on.
One more for in the bin. Whoever works on TV networks who keeps putting Imagine Dragons on the halftime show, because if there's anything to turn off the TV at 2:30, 3:00 in the morning, it is a band who don't seem to have any hits. Just a lot of sound that sounds like music. It's terrible. They're on every halftime show, and they were again on a pretty impressive, pretty enjoyable blowout in the college football playoff on Monday night. Obviously, it's the divisional round, the playoffs, and I saw another talking of someone who makes takes for takes' sake. Colin Cowherd, I don't know if it's Colin Cowherd, but it's on Cowherd's show today, that the Patriots are the worst team left in the NFL playoffs. I mean, that's just Cowherd, but I mean, where would you put these Patriots in compared to the other seven teams in the playoffs, Rob?
Oh, I mean, listen, it's the Patriots. They're in the Super Bowl nearly every year. You know, how could you possibly say they were? I mean, even if you had an inkling that they were the worst, you wouldn't say it, would you? I mean,
he didn't just say it. There was a graphic to support it. I think he had the graphic where he actually ranked the eight teams, and they were eighth.
Yeah, I mean, what Adam was saying earlier, back when the Seahawks was just emerging under Pete Carroll, there was first take. So you had Skip Bayless and Stephen A. Smith, and that was kind of the show, wasn't it? It was that show.
Yeah.
It was that hot take show. And then obviously Skip Bayless has gone and does his show with Shannon Sharp. And then Stephen A. Smith does his show with the guy whose name I can't remember.
Kellerman.
Max, yeah, and then you've got – so before Skip's show on Fox starts, you have the other show with
– Nick Bryant.
You have that one. And then when the Skip show finishes, there's the other one with the four guys on the desk.
Yeah.
And on ESPN –
and then Cowherd.
And you've got Cowherd on as well, and then you've got the other – so basically –
Florio on Sky Sports now, which is not what I needed to see when I was flicking through the channels.
Oh, is that on Sky?
Yeah, Sky Sports USA. They're showing Pro Football Talk for an hour a day.
Jesus.
But you see, the whole network, they've all been taken over by people just delivering hot takes. There's no intelligent football conversation going on. It's all, what can we say that will either, A, wind you up so much that you have to watch this? So if you're a Patriots fan, you're going to watch it because you're so bloody angry that you've got to see what this guy's saying about your team. Or you think it's hilarious and you're like, look at cowards socking it to the Patriots, about time. And then you watch it and it must work because there's all these shows. There's not, I'd much prefer to just see some guys like we are talking intelligently about football, but that's the way it's going. So are the Patriots the worst team in the playoffs? No, but whatever wins for Colin, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. I can't just scroll past, just accept that's what Colin Coward does. He's long been a blowhard and he continues to be and will be for forevermore. But when I was in Arizona, if you scroll through the TV guide, all it is on ESPN 2 or ESPN 3 or whatever, or Hispania, then you've got Fox Sports 1. All they have is repeats of the same four or five shows. I mean, Coward's show used to be a radio show. Now it's a radio show with TV cameras in front of his face. It's just this very weird way of setting up a channel, and no one appears to be watching it apart from when I was trying to waste some time in Arizona. Anything else for a discussion? What did you make of the college football? I mean, a lot of people saying that's as loaded as a college football playoff game or is going to be in terms of future and incoming NFL talent. Do you agree with that? I mean, Clelin Farrell and all the guys like Clemson D-line are just ridiculous. But then you've got the two cornerbacks and in that secondary just put on an absolute clinic on Monday night, didn't they?
Yeah, I think it'll be a surprise if we ever see a championship game with quite as much NFL talent in it as that one. I mean, players that, I'm not just talking about first round picks or even first round picks this year, but ones who are going to go in the future. Just both rosters absolutely loaded, both defensive lines loaded. One of the guys who was expected to declare this year has just announced recently, Raquan Davis, that he's not going to declare and he's going to come back to Alabama next year, which is a bit of a blow for any team looking for defensive. It's another name off the list. Derek Brown at Auburn's going back as well. So Jabari Zuniga's going back from Florida. So there's a few names that are not declaring that people kind of expected would declare. But Clemson's D-line's fantastic. Dexter Lawrence wasn't even playing. Dexter Lawrence, by the way, what I would say, anyone's listening to this, if you see a mock draft that doesn't have Christian Wilkins and Dexter Lawrence going early, I would please just go and find a different one to read, because Dexter Lawrence is 350 pounds and he will run like a 5 second 40 or a sub 5 second 40. I mean, the guy is just ridiculously quick and mobile and athletic and agile. And Christian Wilkins, the teams are just going to love that guy. I mean, he'll be a GM one day. I mean, he's incredible. So a really loaded game. I thought it was fun to watch. It was Alabama spanked so many teams this year. It was kind of fun to see the other it happened the other way around. I kind of like Garbo Swinney. I get the sense that maybe he's quite an acquired taste because he's just so energetic. But I really like him. I think he seems like a cool guy. And the way he coaches his players. My God, you listen to any Clemson player do an interview and they're breaking down coverages. They're saying, oh, yeah, I just attacked the A-gap and did this. And they're not just like, they're taught. They're properly taught technique and scheme, and they know their stuff. I mean, what a production line of talent since Swinney took over. I mean, he's just an incredible job.
Yeah, and also another thing that's come out of that, the eligibility, and if that should be changed in college. Obviously, Trevor Lawrence is a freshman, and only 19 years old, but it looks like he could, with obviously a bit of time, probably be an NFL quarterback in the next couple of years. Do you think that eligibility thing, where they have to be in college for at least 3 years, will change anytime soon, or do you not think it should?
I don't think it ever will change. I think that I don't know what you two guys think. You could certainly make a case for considering changing it.
Yeah.
But if you do that, then you'll ruin college football, and also you'll find a lot of players going into the NFL who just aren't ready to go into the NFL. They will flame out. They'll flame out. They will ruin their careers. Listen, Trevor Lawrence is fantastic. You could watch clips. Rivals, go on the Rivals YouTube page, and they put a clip up, I think, in the last couple of days of him throwing the ball at the sort of the various all star things to do in the recruiting process. And he kind of looked like he was throwing it better than half the quarterbacks in the NFL even then in high school. I mean, he's destined for greatness. But will he benefit? I mean, it's like if you were put, like I did a journalism degree, was I ready to go and be a journalist after 1 year? Maybe. Did I benefit from three? Yes. Is Trevor Lawrence ready to go and be an NFL quarterback? Probably not. Will he be ready after 3 years at Clemson? Yes. So it's kind of a process. It's a learning experience. It's about dealing with setbacks as well as winning championships and sort of taking all that forward with you. And Trevor Lawrence will have 3 years start as the star at Clemson, go into the NFL, and there will never be a day when Trevor Lawrence, unless he has a horrendous injury, touch wood, fingers crossed, that will never happen. He will never turn around and go, I wish I'd only had 1 year at Clemson. He will always say, I benefited so much from my experience there, and it prepared me properly for the NFL.
Well, you'd have found someone to crown Tua in the same way last year, and he'll be a much better quarterback for the year he's had at Alabama this year. So, yeah, nothing worse than when you get kind of one complete outlier and then everything has to change because of that. You know, I think the system works. You don't necessarily want players going in after 2 years. They're not physically ready, and if they sometimes they think they're ready or they're being told by their families they should do it, and that's a prime way to get hurt. And I think that, yeah, as you say, 3 years, he's still going to make a gazillion dollars at some point, and I really don't think he's ever going to worry about, you know, being a 22 instead of 20 going to the NFL.
Yeah, and there's so many examples. The NBA and the college basketball, they do one and done. And there's so many examples of where players just completely fall apart or fall away within 10 weeks of their rookie season after being one and done. Cause
look at the Washington guys.
Yeah, Markelle Fultz. Yeah. Look at him.
Yeah. There's kind of like, they kind of expect every one and done. I mean, I think it's Kentucky who recruit on that fact that, yeah, we'll let you go. We won't stand in your way if you want to be a one-and-done player. And they end up getting some of the top recruits coming out of high school. They're just expecting, unless it's LeBron James, where he didn't even go to college, so went straight to the pros. There's no one like that who's going to change it. And I don't think it, as you both said, I don't think it should either, because there's a process to go through. And it's, as you said, it's going to stand in better stead. And if he does continue on the way he goes, Trevor Lawrence will be like Cam Newton, someone who's won the national, is a national champ and going to be the number one overall pick as well, won't he?
Well, Adam's hit the nail on the head. You shouldn't change the rules because of one guy. Like Trevor Lawrence, maybe he is ready for the NFL. Maybe he would go number one overall if he declared right now. But what about the hundreds and hundreds of players that would sort of think, you know, and players from difficult backgrounds who maybe need the money, who want to take their chance, and then they declare for the draft, and then the NFL teams go, I'm sorry, but you've not even played college football for a year. We're not going to draft you. And then they go as undrafted free agents and they just fizzle out the league because they're not physically developed enough. I mean, here's the thing that people, like Mike Florio goes on about this an awful lot, but you could go and watch videos of David Edwards, who was at Wisconsin, who was just declared for the draft. He's about, 310 pounds now. And then look at videos of him when he first started at Wisconsin. He looked like a linebacker. I mean, he was, you know, he was really skinny and thin and tall. And now he looks like a big offensive lineman. And so, to play this game, you kind of do need to go through the, I'm going to eat X amount of calories a day and gain weight and do all these things and go through the proper nutrition programs and work out and be in the weight room for 3 years. These are just things that you have to do to prepare yourself for the NFL. It's not a fact. It's like with basketball, it's a little bit different because, you know, I mean, look at one of the best players in the league is as skinny as anything, you know, and one of the other ones just looks like a normal guy. He's really short and small, Steph Curry, and he doesn't look like LeBron James. But in the NFL, it's kind of like everybody's bigger, faster, stronger, and you kind of do need to do some physical development there.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys that play high school are not ready to go to the pros, and they need that time. And I don't feel like you should feel guilty for kind of saying, I enjoy college football. I don't want to lose college. I don't want college football to be like college basketball. It's terrible. Yeah. You know, you're losing the players every year. And you know, I kind of like the fact that it's college football is as good as it is. And I think most people, the vast majority, like 98% of players who play college football benefit from the 3 or 4 years they have in college football. And we shouldn't be over-exaggerating because the running back, Marcus Lattimore, had a horrible injury a few years ago, or Jalen Smith had his injury in his bowl game, or Trevor Lawrence is now ready for the NFL. Think about the hundreds who benefit from college.
Yeah, I agree. And I think they showed on Saturday night during the Texans game the difference in Deshaun Watson from the combine to what he looks like now in just the upper body physique. It kind of, like you say, you get on that weight program, you get on the program that the NFL teams put you on, it changes everything. It stands you in good stead to take the hits, especially that Deshaun Watson takes behind that Texans O-line, doesn't it, Adam?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, this isn't to say that I don't think college players should receive some sort of financial incentive beyond a scholarship to play, because I do think that it's a bit of an abuse of a system. And when you see college coaches complaining that their guys aren't going to play in bowl games, you know, that does grind my gears a bit. But, you know, I started a catering business at the age of 24 and I did a history degree for 3 years at university. I wouldn't have been mentally right to start the business 3 years in advance, even though the degree ultimately was pointless. So even just as a human maturation process, you sometimes, you know, a few years later down the line, it can extend what you do, you know, infinitesimally more because you're just more ready as a person.
Yeah. Yeah, quickly back on to NFL. What do you make of the hirings made in the NFL? Obviously, you mentioned Cliff Kingsbury, who ran Baker Mayfield out of Texas Tech, didn't win much with Patrick Mahomes, has now got an NFL job on a team which has just fired the coach after one losing season, Rob.
Yeah, the problem that Cliff Kingsbury's going to have is appointing a staff. Like, if when Sean McVay got the job in LA, they got Wade Phillips, and Sean McVay had actually been part of the NFL for a long time, you know, because his family, his granddad's very much in the NFL, isn't he? So he'd been part of it a long time. Cliff Kingsbury's going to go into this, and his best contact's going to be Tom Brady, you know, who he used to muck around with. And how is he going to put a staff together? And, he's going into a team that has got holes everywhere. You know, they've got quarterback that you're not quite sure if is the answer. You've got defensive issues. Is Larry Fitzgerald going to carry on? The offensive line shot to pieces. You know, they need probably two or three drafts away from being really competitive, and yet they brought him in probably expecting this great offensive mastermind to succeed straight away. This is a guy that historically chose David Webb over Baker Mayfield. Didn't win anywhere near as enough games with Patrick Mahomes than you would think he should have done by now, with the way we've seen Mahomes develop in the NFL. And his teams were defensively just horrendous when he's coached. So I actually see this as a big positive for the Seahawks that, you know, maybe he may help Josh Rosen a little bit, but what's he going to do for the defense? So I kind of look forward to playing the Cardinals next year.
Yeah, same here. So obviously we get a long time to talk about everything as we keep saying. Maybe try and get you back on before, during, or after the combine, Rob, and talk more draft. We've had more things to look at the players. That'd be good for you.
Hey, anytime.
Yeah. Cool. Yes, obviously, if you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can on the possessionpodcast.podbean.com. On Twitter, it's at Seahawkers UK. On Facebook, it's UK Seattle Seahawks fans. On Twitter, it's at UK Seahawkers, and website is ukseahawkers.com. We still have a few spaces left for our meet for the Super Bowl on Broad Street in Birmingham at O'Neill's, about 15 or so spaces before we have to close it up. We're going to be closing it up probably some point towards the back end of next week, so we can let the place know how many numbers to open up space for. That's really good night watching the Super Bowl. Obviously, a lot less stressful now. The Seahawks clearly won't be involved. I just can't watch another Super Bowl with a Patriots fan with the Patriots in it, because that's just too mean at the end of this season. But if you want to get in touch, we do encourage you getting in touch. We'll probably do another few podcasts. We're going to try and get some fun guests on as we edge towards 100 podcasts. Enjoy the rest of the playoffs. Enjoy the Super Bowl from wherever you watch it. Thank you for listening to the Pedestrian Podcast this season, and we'll be back during the off season.
Stu, before you sign off, but aside from the bin, Rob has given us 2 hours of his time. So where can they find him?
SeahawksDraftBlog.com is the website, and we're going to be talking an awful lot about the off season. We've got Senior Bowl coming up. Combine, already booked the days off work to get into all that again, and then we'll be doing live blogs there, and a lot of coverage, and a really good bunch of people who are the complete opposite of Seahawks Twitter on the comment section and don't deliver hot takes and get on with each other. So if you want to get involved in the discussion, then we'd love to have you as well.
Definitely do recommend doing that. Obviously, following you on Twitter as well. Is it at Rob Staten?
It is.
Yeah. So, until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks.
season was a season of growth and progress and proven and coming to grips with who we are and what we could do and in a great fashion. It was so much fun to see these guys grow and to see them see the future and to go for it and not take a step back at any time as far as how they went about it. We come out of here with a great feeling about our future. Our guys are excited about it. They know that we can do some damage in the playoffs. They know that we can go a long ways, and they know that they have a lot of work ahead of them too. And there's all the indications that, you know, where you come up short, there's enough of them. There's enough lessons here that we've learned, I love this team, and I love where we're going, and it's going to be more competitive than ever. The roster will continue to be built and constructed to be competitive and bring out the best in our guys. It's evident to me that we made a connection with our fans, that they can feel our team and they can feel the future with us, and it's exciting.